Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnarblog. James, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Andrew. How's it going?
It's going all right. You know, my daughter is home from Barcelona this weekend, so it's nice to see her. And she came bearing the gift of ham on ruffles. So whatever else has happened this weekend, I've had the ham-on-y, salty goodness of those ruffles in my mouth.
That is some consolation. I think we may be kind of, well, it's no surprise really, but psychically linked in some way. I happened to go on your Instagram story about an hour ago.
Okay.
And I saw that you had been partaking of a Basque cheesecake.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
At that very moment, I was at a farmer's market in North London.
Wow.
Where there was a woman selling Basque cheesecake, and I tried a sample of said Basque cheesecake, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It
is moments apart.
It is good, I have to say.
I didn't know it was a thing. It's a thing, is it?
Yeah,
Basque cheesecake.
It is. It's a very popular thing, particularly if you go to somewhere like San Sebastian. There are places that are very famous for it. I think the place is called La Viña, and they just sell mountains of this cheesecake every single day. It's on the tourist trail if you go there. But it is an amazing confectionery, whatever you want to call it, because it's just, you know, cream cheese and double cream and sugar and maybe a bit of vanilla or lime, whatever you want to put into it, but it's baked in the oven. So it comes out with this kind of blackened top. But if you get it right, if you get it just right, it's kind of gooey in the middle. You know, it's not like crumbly or, you know, it's solid, but it's got that little bit of goo in the middle. And I hope the one that you had that goo.
It did. I mean, I literally tried like a thimble's full. Because Camille is dairy intolerant, I couldn't justify. It was too dangerous for me to buy an entire cheesecake because I would have to eat it all.
You would.
But yeah, just a weird little coincidence.
There you go.
It's nice having your daughter there to distract you. I should say, just before my son was born, I had a conversation with Amy Lawrence, who is a very wise person. And she said to me, you know, the great thing is, once you have your child, you know, if Arsenal don't get the result, they don't win, they lose or they drop points, it just doesn't hurt quite the same. You go home to them, you see their little face. You know, they look
smiling
up at you.
Yeah.
The result just sort of fades away. And why did she lie to me, Andrew? Why did Amy Lawrence lie?
Amy, how could you?
I know. I'm furious. Furious with her. That's the only reason I had a kid.
To take the pain of Arsenal away, and he's not even doing that for you.
I know. By the way, we're not in a great position to laugh at teams conceding early goals this week, but
right.
It will hearten you to hear that 6 minutes into the game at St James's Park, Newcastle lead Spurs by 2-0.
Oh, that's good and bad, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we still have to go there. So, you know, let's hope that they can somehow sew up Champions League over the next 90 minutes. I mean, if they keep scoring at this rate, they may well do.
Could be like 17-0 by the end. And then they'll have used up all their goals for the rest of the season, at which point we'll have nothing to worry about by the time we get to St. James's Park. I guess there is perhaps a feeling that we might not have anything to worry about by the time we get to St. James's Park anyway, after what happened on Friday night. So, I mean, let me ask you this. I mean, how are you feeling now with 2 days detachment? I tried to write about it a bit in the blog today where I'm sort of, you know, upset and obviously disheartened by what we did and the mistakes we made and the fact we dropped 2 points. And, you know, there's a part of me that goes, you know, that's not good when you're scrapping for a title, regardless of who you're fighting against, but especially when you're fighting against Man City. You know, I'm quite dismayed, I guess, in general. But then I'm sort of talking myself around in other ways. In the, like, you never know. Haaland could just sort of career into De Bruyne and smash up both their legs. And then, you know, Ederson could, spontaneous combustion. There's no real evidence that it could happen. But maybe Phil Foden just sort of disappears into a puff of smoke and they've used up all their subs and we're playing nine-man City. You know, that kind of thing where I'm hanging on in there. I'm trying to, because there was a great tweet, actually. I can't remember exactly who it was by. Maybe it was by Paddy Arsenal, who said only Arsenal could make being 5 points clear at the top of the table feel bad.
Yeah, it is.
I think it was him. Apologies if it's not. But
there's a sketch that was doing the rounds on TikTok or Instagram in a similar vein. It's like an Arsenal fan's really upset and his partner's asking him, like, what's wrong? And he's like, we're top of the league. Like, is that bad? He's like, yeah, of course it's bad. Means we're going to screw it up. It's the hope that kills you, I guess. How do I feel? I'm not sure how I feel. It's a lot to unpack and digest. And I think I wasn't quite prepared for this. I think I'd spent the whole season looking at the fixture list and thinking, Anfield, yeah, St. James's Park, the Etihad.
Mm.
They're kind of where I'd sort of psychologically prepared myself for it unraveling. I didn't have Upton Park or the London Stadium down, and certainly not in the manner that it was there. And I certainly didn't have at home to the bottom team in Southampton as being one of the games where it might be the case. And all those three games, Liverpool, West Ham and Southampton, are sort of crazy enough that were they in isolation, you go, well, that's just a mad game. That's just a mad thing that happened. But it keeps happening. Yeah. And I think you have to, at this point, say that there's something more to that. There's a pattern to that. And the table still, as you say, it's not hideous to look at. Top, and you know, yes, they've got games in hand and we've got to play them, but they've got to play us and all that kind of thing. I think it's just more this, that sort of cumulative feeling of we're certainly not defending like a team about to win the league.
I think that's fair. I found the tweet actually by Paddy at Paddy Arsenal. He said, only Arsenal can make being top of the league and unbeaten in 10 games feel bad.
Yeah,
and I know exactly what he means by that, because, you know, when you say it like that, we haven't lost since the Manchester City game. We've accumulated a lot of points. We are top of the league. It is, you know, ostensibly still in our hands. But I think we all recognize that the margin for error is now well and truly gone. And when you're competing with a team like Manchester City, you want that margin to be as big as possible. Like, you want the error part to be on Man City and you want the margin to be for us. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's you're right. Like, we won 7 in a row and then we've drawn 3 in a row. And had we got those 10 results in a different order, we'd probably be looking on this as like a really impressive run. But they haven't come in that order. And it does feel like a big stumble. I keep I used the word haunted a lot last week, and yeah. I am haunted by 6 points across those three games that we really have let go. And, you know, what about the position? It doesn't bear thinking about the position that we would be in with those points.
I know, and that's, you know, we're all doing those sort of mental gymnastics to think, well, if only, if only, if only. But, you know, a football season is absolutely full of if onlys from start to finish.
Yeah.
And, you know, the before we get into the nuts and bolts of this game, I think the thing that is not consoling me but keeping me going? I mean, that's a ridiculous thing to even say, isn't it? The thing that's keeping me going as we're top of the table, unbeaten in 10 games, we're at 5 points clear, albeit Manchester City have games in hand, but if you win our game at Man City, blah, 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 you know, is the fact that I would much rather this than anything else.
Oh, as for sure.
As acute as the pain is and as much as it hurts, you know, you kind of forget how much of a gut punch it is when you drop points in games that really, really, really matter. And these games really matter. And for too long, we've had so many games that don't really matter. Are we going to finish sixth or seventh? You know, are we going to finish in the Europa League places or the Europa League conference places or out of Europe? You know, these things, you know, even in previous seasons, you know, the games haven't really mattered in the way that these ones do. So that's kind of my fuel. And I know it sounds absurd to say it, but also the fact that, and this is not a new observation, we talked a little bit about this on the Arsecast on Friday, myself and Lewis, is that this, the bar has been raised so high that everything that, everything you do has to be viewed through the context of what the most relentless team in Premier League history are going to do, more than likely. So you know that a draw is it almost feels like a defeat, even though away from home, you know, you could typically look at a draw as a reasonable result, particularly at Anfield. But this is the context in which the Premier League exists right now, and that's why we're all feeling this, I think.
Yes, I mean, if City complete the treble, they may go down as, you know, one of the greatest sides of all time, albeit one, you know, that should be, given the amount of money that's been spent on it. But that is what we're up against. It's funny, it's the London Marathon today, mm-hmm. this morning, and it was on TV, and they were showing some of the guys leading at the front, and the analysts were saying, if you watch now, you just see every so often the front runner there, he keeps looking back over his shoulder. And psychologically, you know, when you're in one of these long races and you have that glance over your shoulder and you keep seeing that the person behind you, they're not losing ground, they're staying with you. It's like that makes you feel more tired. The race becomes harder at that point. And I was watching this being like, is this a wind-up? Are you talking to me directly? Because that is what we've been experiencing, a marathon where City have just kept the pace up. They've been absolutely relentless of late. All those conversations of they don't look quite right. Haaland, you know, is disturbing them, destabilizing them. Mm. They look like they've got mistakes in them. That's all quiet and down. And actually, I think one of the kind of the story, if they do go on and win it, of Guardiola letting Cancelo go in January, effectively inventing a new formation to get the best out of Haaland and the best out of his team. You know, that is a big story in itself and has been a massive factor in the second half of the campaign. But I it was so funny watching the marathon, just thinking like, yeah, I see how there may be a kind of mental fatigue for these players and a physical fatigue at this point in time.
Yeah.
And of course, we're measuring every result, as you say, against a raised bar. But the reason that I can't find it in me to be angry, like I'm disappointed and I'm sad about the games we haven't won, but I can't find it in me to be angry with this group, with these players or with this manager, because they are the guys who have raised those expectations.
Sure.
And they've done so in a really dramatic way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about anger is usually it stems from, you know, an inability to correct mistakes that are continuous and things that happen all the time, and they just happen over and over and over again. And what's been notable about the last number of weeks is that the uncharacteristic defensive errors are exactly that. They're uncharacteristic because you don't get to where we've got to this season by making those mistakes week in, week out, you know? Yeah. And look, everyone has their own way of dealing with disappointment or a bad result. So if you want to be angry, be angry. If you want to be, you know, whatever, be whatever. I mean, no one's telling you what to do or think or how to behave or anything like that. But you know, I'm kind of with you in that I feel sad more than anything. Disappointed, sad, and sort of a little bit gutted because, you know, I know how hard they've worked to get to this point. I know how hard and how well they've done to put us in this position, you know? And unfortunately, I mean, I think there is a really big discussion to be had about the psychological aspect of being in this position and maybe being in this position for the first time for some of these players, you know? All these buzzwords that get thrown around about choking and bottling and all those kinds of things, I just think it's boring. It's really not at all interesting to sort of frame it in that way. But let's not be blind to the fact that in football, in most top-level sport, there is a psychological element that sometimes you have to learn via, if you want to call it failure, you can call it failure, but maybe not quite getting over the line, right? So if you're a golfer, if you're a footballer, if you're a tennis player, if you're whatever, you come close and you're not quite there and you're not quite good enough to beat the world number one. And you do it again, maybe, and you're not quite there to beat the world number one. But maybe from those experiences, that's how you do it the next time, you know? And I'm not trying to paint a sort of picture that, like, okay, we're going to have to go through all kinds of pain to get to where we need to go. But it's not unusual that in order to develop and grow as a team, as we saw last season when we didn't get top four, we use the motivation, we use the experiences to get better again this season. And I think at the heart of why I feel somewhat relaxed in my sadness is that I think this team and this manager have demonstrated an ability to show that from adversity or, in inverted commas, failure, they can learn and they can improve and they can get better again. And that's what I truly believe that we are capable of as a team and as a club right now. So there's some solace in that, even if what we did on Friday night was absolutely maddening and annoying.
By the way, just a quick update from
7-0,
Andrew. It's 5-0 to Newcastle after 21 minutes.
Fuck off, really?
Yeah. So, you know, every cloud.
I take back what I said about bottling. You know, there is a context in which that can be used. And it applies directly to Tottenham Hotspur and only to Tottenham Hotspur.
That is extraordinary. No, I think you're absolutely right. I suppose the counterpoint to that, and, you know, one that I've seen a few people mentioning online, is what's happening at the end of this season reminiscent of what happened at the end of last season? I don't know. Maybe.
You know, key injuries or injuries to some players have impacted us. I think it's easy to draw that parallel, but then, you know, it doesn't mean it's going to happen every time. We came close to what we wanted to do last season. We didn't get there. We don't know yet what's going to happen between now and the end of the season, but if we don't get there, we will have come close. So, you know, that's the sort of side of it that I'm hanging on to. I think even if it is reminiscent, it's sort of better is not the right word. Because there's still some games to go or whatever. But, I don't think that because it happened last season and we've had a little bit of a wobble, as I wrote in the blog today, my friend West Antone is going, you know, we are still capable of doing three bad results, but three bad results are draws rather than defeats, as was the case
that's
this time
true.
Last year. You know, so
that's
maybe,
very true.
Maybe that's something.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. It's sort of impossible to say, isn't it? But we are a sort of ahead of schedule. There's a lot made of Mikel Arteta's, we're at phase three. Do you remember that comment he made?
Yeah.
Phase three of five, and everyone's been kind of puzzling out what that might be. But I have my own idea, which is that, and it's complete guesswork, but phase one to me seems to be like stabilization and renewal. Phase two could be get back into Europe of some kind. Mm-hmm. That's last season. We very nearly got Champions League, ultimately got the Europa League, achieved phase two. Stage three, Champions League qualification. We're in it at the moment. We're actually contesting for the title. Stage four, would be to compete in the Premier League and in Europe in a serious way, and stage five be in a position to actually win those things.
Mm.
That seems to me to be like a reason. If I was a manager pitching a five-year plan, that's something like what it would look like. And basically, you know, over the last couple of years, we've been ahead of the curve. And maybe there is some catching up for us to do before we're really ready to get over the line. But we're talking like it's over and it's not happening.
Well,
and
yeah, I know.
It's still to play for.
But that's, I think, a defense mechanism or a coping mechanism or whatever. And you know, when the disappointment is acute, it's really difficult to convince people. It's difficult to convince yourself, not least because of how difficult it's going to be anyway, that if you go to Man City and you win a game, then it's back the fuck on in a big way, you know?
Mm.
And I do wonder, yeah, I do. I think this is just part and parcel of what we have to go through when you're at this end of the table, where it's just so disheartening every time you don't get the result that you want. And in particular, you know, a game like this where you're at home on a Friday night to the team that's bottom of the table, you know, which is its own dynamic, you know, at this point of the season, because they're not like bottom of the table on 10 points, like some kind of Derby County back in the day. You know, Southampton aren't a bad side. I don't think there are really too many bad sides in this league anymore. But I think that's evident as well because of how close it is right down at the bottom. But when you don't win a game like this, people will say, well, you don't deserve to be champions if you can't beat Southampton at home on a Friday night. You know, if you can't respond to two draws by turning up and winning, you know, and I get that. I completely get that. That may well turn out to be true. I hope it isn't. Hopefully this may turn out to be an important point. You just never know. But it's difficult to convince people of that, and I get that completely. So, look, let's talk a bit about the game. The team selection, no Granit Xhaka. So Fabio Vieira started in midfield. Alexander Zinchenko was back. Apart from that, I think it was pretty much as expected.
Mm-hmm.
You want a bright start? You want a composed start? You want a... You want to impose yourself on the game? You don't want to do what we did. And I know there's a school of thought that says, you know what, if you're going to make a mistake, it's better to make that mistake in the first minute than the 89th minute, which I suppose is true. But I think it's much better not to make that mistake because it was just so basic and avoidable from Aaron Ramsdale. I mean, he held his hands up straight away, as he would, but that's a nightmare start. And I think in some ways it sets the tone for what you need to do, you know? The way games can change, the momentum, all that kind of stuff. But giving a goal away in the first minute, how do you even explain it?
I don't know. And again, it's another question I would ask. Can it be coincidence that Arsenal have conceded or nearly conceded goals in the opening moments of home games quite a lot recently. It's obviously a terrible individual error from Aaron Ramsdale. And I think there are times in a season where something like that happening might not be a catastrophe because, you know, it might sharpen the team's instincts or just get them in the game. I think at this particular point, after what happened at Anfield and what happened at West Ham, I think it was the last thing that Arsenal needed. And I think it engendered a kind of shakiness and uncertainty, particularly in the sort of defensive third, that did real damage. So, yeah, it was an awful start, the worst possible start. And so interesting, you know, you look at what happened at West Ham. Thomas Partey tries a turn we've seen him do 100 times or more this season, gets caught. Aaron Ramsdale makes a pass again that we've seen him make countless times, gets it wrong. Is that pressure? Can it just be coincidence that those errors have happened at this time? You know, we can never be sure, but it feels like it may be a factor there.
Yeah. And the only thing I can think of, sorry, to cut across, the only thing I can think of was that Ramsdale was trying to set the tone in a way, that he can. We've seen him make these passes. He's going, okay, I know I've got Gabriel on one side, Rob Holding on the other. And by the way, I think, you know, Rob Holding should be demanding the ball off his goalkeeper in that position, because he's sort of facing him, and I think he actually points to Zinchenko, who's gesturing for the ball. But I think, you know, does that get the crowd going straight away? If the keeper makes a pass between two Southampton players, Zinchenko takes the ball, drives into midfield, bang, 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 away we go up the other end. I'm not saying we score a goal, but you sort of drive forward. That's the only explanation I have for what Ramsdale did there.
Yeah, I think they would have talked about Southampton historically and a little bit of late. They've been a side that will press and, you know, look to close the space. And they probably said, you know, we've got to play through them. That's why Zinchenko's come and stood in the centre of the pitch like that. And it's Ramsdale trying to be positive and progressive. But it wasn't on, really. I mean, I think he's duped, isn't he, by the Southampton forward who makes it look like he's switched off when he's very, very much alive.
Yeah, he's hiding, isn't he? He's hiding behind Partey.
He hides behind him. Not enough pace on the pass. Sneaks in. You know, I think when you play the way we do, probably every season or two, you're going to concede a goal like that. You know, Edison does it. Alisson does it. Again, it was just the worst possible time. The worst possible time for it. And then I think, I to be honest, I think he could have done better on the shot. I think he could have a stronger hand. But
I mean, I think that's the sort of... maybe he could, but, you know, realistically, he shouldn't have to be making a save there because he shouldn't be giving the ball away.
Yeah, and he's not set or positioned how he would want to be. A huge... What's the word? Like a sucker punch, really, you know, right at the start of the game. I think a lot of fans probably hadn't even really settled in their seats, you know, and suddenly we're a goal down.
And it got worse, of course, because Theo Walcott scored a very Theo Walcott goal. How many times have we seen him do that at the Emirates? Sharp movement. Again, I don't think the defending from Arsenal is particularly good. We lose the ball in midfield. There's a lot of space for them to run into.
It's a very high, very, very high risk thing Odegaard does, you know, by playing a ball inside a bit blind and it's cut out. He and Partey are basically taking out the game. I don't think Gabriel will be pleased with his defending when he watches it back in terms of, you know, anyone who knows anything about Theo Walcott knows what he wants to do as soon as Alcaraz has the ball. He wants to peel off and you know, Gabriel, I don't think, is wise enough to it.
It's a lovely pass. I mean, you've got to say.
It's a brilliant pass. Yeah. It's a brilliant, brilliant pass.
It's a lovely pass, clinical finish. And, you know.
How many times have we seen that goal?
Yeah. I mean, I felt like at times in this game, and I don't want to cast aspersions on Theo Walcott's professionalism at all, but I do feel like there were some times in this game where maybe he got a couple of things wrong that he could have got right. Maybe that's ridiculous for me to say.
It was very much a no celebration, wasn't it?
You know? Can I ask you what you thought about what happened next? Where Zinchenko got the players into a bit of a huddle. I'm curious what you thought about it. And I'll tell you what I thought about it after.
Okay. So I the TV commentary were very sceptical. I was all right with it. Only because... we've seen similar things, huddles after scoring, huddles after conceding, and I felt it looked necessary. Like, I felt like we were all over the place at that point in time. So I was okay with it, but what did you think?
I wasn't mad for it, to be honest, I have to say. I just thought it was... I don't know. I think you can do what he did without doing that. You know, I think as a professional footballer, when you're 2-0 down after 14 minutes, you don't necessarily need to get into a huddle to be told what you need to do. And I think the intentions were good. I think he really wants to try and show leadership. But it's so unusual to see something like that it stuck out a little bit for me. And I think even Odegaard came over and had a bit of a word, didn't he? Because I don't think he got into the huddle. Maybe he went over the sidelines and had a word with the manager or something. I'm not sure. But he came over and then seemed to have a word with Zinchenko. So look, I wasn't mad for it. Maybe it's because it's unusual and I'm not used to seeing it. Then again, we did score not too long afterwards. And I suppose any effort to try and focus everybody after such a terrible start isn't the worst thing in the world. But just, you know, yeah, I wasn't mad for it. But
I get it. There's something, I'm trying to think of the right adjective.
Performative?
It felt a little bit gallusy, if that makes any sense.
Yes, that's it. And look, I'll leave it there, yeah.
But I was all right with it.
All right.
I think I think everyone will feel differently about it. I felt like, because, you know, Gary Neville was very sort of critical of it on TV. Mm. And I was kind of like, yeah, but if you'd seen Arsenal doing this over the course of the season in different circumstances, you might. It's not as atypical as he was making out. But
no, I mean,
whatever it was, we were a mess at that point in time.
We were a bit of a mess. And I suppose you could draw parallels between, let's say, the opposition having a bit of a chance and then the goalkeeper goes down and Mikel Arteta brings all his players over to the sideline to have a little bit of a coaching break.
Yeah.
It might have been, you know, along those kinds of lines. But I mean, the goal we scored was a really lovely goal, and I think a really good time to score that goal. You know, it worked well, didn't it, with getting the ball to Odegaard in midfield. He plays Saka into Martinelli. I mean, it's a really good finish for Martinelli, isn't it?
It's a great goal all round. Mm. Saka does brilliantly, I think.
I mean, it starts with, and this is probably something we'll talk about, it starts with Thomas Partey. Well, we have possession, but then it comes to Thomas Partey, who is playing basically as the right-sided centre half.
Yes, we sort of changed how we built up with Partey dropping in alongside Holding to try and help us get out there, which, you know, is telling in its own way. I was really struck in the first half by how happy Southampton were to let Rob Holding have the ball.
Mm-hmm.
There were times where every player would be marked and they would, if Holding had it, they would just back off. They weren't worried at all about that.
Mm.
And clearly it's something that they've looked at and tried to tweak. And as you say, goal started building up in that way. I think, to be honest, I think it hurt us more than it hindered us at times. Like, I think,
I agree.
You know, our team is so immaculately engineered to a point of precision. And I think having to change that and change that shape, it also meant Partey was a little bit absent when Southampton broke on us at occasions. Mm-hmm. He wasn't where you would expect. And I think we suffered for that time. So, yeah, it was a case of trying to adapt, really, for the absence of William Saliba. But I understand the reasoning, but yeah. I don't think it was hugely successful.
I mean, there were moments at both ends, to be fair, in the first half. I think Ramsdale had to make a good double save at one point. And towards the end of the half, we had some moments. Gabriel headed over, and then there was the Ben White chance from a corner, I think, which was cleared off the line.
That was right before half-time, I think.
Before half-time. It was a really good, really good clearance off the line. I think it was Alcaraz, who was basically Southampton's best player.
Probably came off.
Yeah,
at the interval.
I mean,
but yeah. It wasn't like we had an avalanche of chances.
No,
I think Southampton. Obviously, there was quite a serious injury, wasn't there? What's the boy's name?
Bednarek.
Bednarek. Yes, I always get Bednarek and Vestergaard as footballers confused. I think they were at one point both at Southampton. It's really confusing for me. But it was Bednarek who, had that nasty fall. And that, in a weird way, you never want to say this is an injury, but helped Southampton, killed the momentum of the game, I think, a bit, slowed things down. And then, yeah, at half-time, they made the switch to a back five, which ultimately, I guess they'll feel was the right one.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that was quite a brave substitution or a brave tactical decision from Ruben Selles.
Took their best player off, yeah.
Well, yeah, I know he was on a yellow card, but then so too were his two fullbacks, weren't they? Walker Peters was booked, and the other guy, Perro, on the other side. You know, they'd both been booked. So it was clearly more tactical than worrying about, you know, a yellow card from, you know, it's not like Alcaraz is going to be a sort of hatchet man in midfield or anything like that. The sort of change that you would you might make if you're 20 minutes to go or 15 minutes to go and you're trying to hang on to a lead, but at halftime it was a little bit brave. Were you surprised that Mikel Arteta didn't make a halftime change?
A little, little. He doesn't do it a ton, so it's why would be wrong to say I expected it. But you know, Vieira had come in for Xhaka, and I think we were suffering a little bit for that in the middle of the pitch. I think it's easy to say when he doesn't play and you don't win the game, but I do think that we really miss Xhaka on the night.
I think I don't think that's unreasonable or outrageous in any way to say, considering how well Xhaka has played this season. And, you know, on a night like this where there's experience, he was missed, no question about it, which is why I think this was a really important game. I said something on Twitter about this, you know, before kickoff, that this is a big chance for Fabio Vieira because, you know, we've seen flashes of what he can do this season, but not a huge amount. He did start the game against Bournemouth, I think, when Xhaka was left on the bench.
He did, yeah.
But this was like, okay, we need you. You're the guy that we're putting in to replace Granit Xhaka, who's been a very important player for us this season. We need you to deliver. And I'm not writing him off or anything like that, but I think it just told us that he's not quite ready yet. He's not quite ready yet to do that job. And I know hindsight is 2020 and all the rest of it, but I do wonder if Mikel Arteta himself might think, you know what? Maybe because it's Southampton at home, I could start Kieran Tierney at left back and I could play Oleksandr Zinchenko in midfield, mm-hmm. you know, which is where he plays a lot. I wouldn't have been at all worried or surprised to see Leandro Trossard start in there as well. A home game against Southampton. You know, this is the kind of game where I think you can take a bit of a risk, which I suppose Vieira was in that sense. I think he really struggled. He found it very tough going. I think he's a nice player when he's got time and space and room, but when the game is going on around him, it tends to pass him by a little bit at this point in his Arsenal career. So, you know, I was a touch surprised that he lasted after halftime, but not at all surprised that he was taken off after, what, 10 minutes? It was about 10 minutes of the
second half? Yeah, it was fairly early on.
I'm just going to check the live blog here. Feels like... I don't have it here.
I think everyone would have had that as their first change, probably.
56 minutes. So in the 11th minute of the second half, he came off for Trossard.
And actually, the suggestion you made of Tierney at left-back, Zinchenko in midfield, I think would have made particular sense against the Southampton team with Theo Walcott in it. You know, you know exactly the sort of spaces he's going to look to exploit. And, you know, they're the spaces that Zinchenko likes to vacate.
Yeah.
We haven't ever seen it, though. I don't think we've ever seen, really, Zinchenko start as a midfielder in this
Arsenal
team.
No, it's a bit strange, you know, because, to be fair, normally there isn't the opportunity to give it a try or your hand isn't forced in that way. And look, I know in all likelihood Kieran Tierney is going to be off in the summer. You know, people will feel differently about that. But I think another factor to this is that in a game like this, you know, Tierney has been the distance and won titles at Celtic. And I know it's a different league and all the rest of it, but I just wonder if in this circumstance, that little bit of experience of the business end of the season might just have been more useful than sort of hoping that Fabio Vieira could sort of flourish, or this could be the game where he blossoms, you know, that way.
Yeah, yeah. And so on comes Trossard, but then, what is it, another 10 minutes and we're 3-1 down.
Yes. I mean, a corner we did not need to concede. I don't think. I think it was sloppy from Partey. And
Zinchenko and Partey failed to play out. Ball goes behind. Listen, every dead ball against Southampton is a threat, right? Because of James Ward-Prowse and his delivery.
But it wasn't even Ward-Prowse who took it, was it? Because it was.
Was it not?
Right. I don't think so. Because my, I could be wrong.
I think it was.
Was it? Oh, okay. My recollection is that it was an in-swinger, but you're probably right, actually. Why would anyone but Ward-Prowse take it?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, and listen, it's a great delivery, but this set-piece problem has been with Arsenal for a long time now, you know, a number of months. It predates the absence of William Saliba. That much is sure. And, you know, we're just conceding way too many goals.
You're right. It is. It's Ward-Prowse. I should never have doubted you or his set-piece ability.
and it is a great ball and it's immaculately, that's the word of the podcast for me today, but that it's perfectly executed, isn't it? The near post flick.
It is, but it's poorly defended as well. It's poorly defended. When you look at it again, the guy who holding is marking just steps in front of him. I mean, it's basic stuff. You know, he can't let your guy get goal side from a set piece. He flicks it on. I think Zinchenko and Saka are probably ball watching a little bit at the back post and the guy heads it home. So, I mean, 3-1, I have to say, I was in a sort of state of disbelief and mild nausea at that point.
And I think you weren't alone in that. I think that was... I wasn't at the ground Friday night, but through the TV, that was what I could see from the stands and from the players as well. Mm. There were a lot of shaking heads on the pitch after that goal.
Yeah, you know, I can't believe this.
Yeah, I think they were in shock. And to be honest, it took them the best part of the rest of the game to resuscitate.
Well... You say that, but like within a minute of them scoring the third goal, we had a massive chance.
What was that one?
That was the one when Gabriel Martinelli curled it to the back post and Gabriel Jesus put it over the bar.
Yeah.
And I think he should score there. I'm sorry. He should score. I love him, but I don't think he had a good game on Friday night.
No. My brother texted me afterwards and he was like, how's Jesus not scored in that game?
Yeah.
And I know what he means because there were just a number of sort of pretty decent opportunities. And you know, he's not going to take everyone. He's never been that player. But the form he's in, you'd expect him to take one. And listen, he was part of some pretty good moments in the second half. You know, I thought his hold-up play was good. He had a couple of nice spins in the box. He was very much involved in the equalising goal. But his finishing, it is what it is, right? Like, he's a brilliant player who isn't the most efficient in front of goal. I think we like to believe that when players change clubs, their spots change too. But I think that's just part of who he is. But even he would typically, I think, get a goal out of the combined chances that he had against Southampton.
No, and that one in particular, you know, if because it was deflated, I'm looking at it again. Oh my God, you know, it's there. He just needs to keep it down, put it either side of the goalkeeper, and it's 3-2 in the 69th minute. Yeah. You know, and that then.
That's a very different
scenario. When you consider what we did in the final 10 minutes of this game and how close we actually came to winning it in 10 minutes, in basically, you know, 2 minutes of normal time plus 8 minutes of added time, how close we came. If you go 3-2 there, who knows? But of course, I mean, the big issue, the main issue is that you've conceded three goals. You know, we can talk about our strikers, we can talk about our attackers, we can talk about missed chances, we can talk about being slightly unlucky with one or two of them in the end, but, you know, you can't concede three goals. You just can't concede three goals.
No, you've given yourself a mountain to climb.
Yeah, exactly.
It is that, you know.
Yeah.
We scored enough goals to win this game 9 times out of 10 if you defend.
Yeah, correct.
And that's the thing. Like, we still scored three goals on the night. That should be enough to win you any football match if you're defending properly.
Yeah, or even half properly.
Yeah, and to be honest, yeah, exactly, exactly. Like, and the first goal, it is a catastrophic error, but it's something that can happen.
Mm.
To concede that, like, the other two goals are just sort of sloppy. Like, they're just not great defending. Do you know what I mean? They're not huge individual errors. They're just a team that isn't really sharp and focused. And that third goal that they got was an absolute killer. And I think it was a consequence of minds being on, we've got to chase this game. We've got to score goal. I think the focus wasn't right. And and as you know, we had that opportunity through Jesus, and got to give some credit to Gabriel Martinelli, who I thought was like the guy for Arsenal in that first, you know, hour or whatever it was. He looked like the one who's going to make something happen.
Yeah.
I've seen very divided views on Bukayo Saka's game on the opposite flank.
Right.
But I thought he was good as well. I thought he looked like, you know, a threat.
I mean, I think the goal, the third goal, is maybe a slight blot on his copybook, but you know, the other thing to take into account with Saka is, you know, the way that the team is now leaning left more than right when we attack. And I spoke about this on Friday as well. There was a good article on Sky Sports about how we are not getting the ball down the right-hand side the way we normally do. Therefore, there's a lot more emphasis on the left side of the attack. I think Gabriel Martinelli ended up with 6 key passes in the game, you know, goal. I agree with you. I think he was brilliant, but also I think Saka was very good as well. I think the 2 21-year-olds on either side of our attack were the ones who showed the most leadership and the most and contributed the most in this particular game, you know, as well as maybe Martin Odegaard when he sprung into life as well in the final part of the game. So let's just
talk about that, though. We didn't have a shot on target, did we, for like the vast majority of the second half?
I'm just trying to see. We hit the woodwork, but I think that was offside.
There were a couple of nearly moments. I remember Saka putting in a couple of sort of, you know, crosses across the box that, you know, people didn't quite get onto or didn't get good contact.
There was a couple, wasn't it? Bazunu who made a save from Saka. Can we talk about the changes? Because we did make more changes. Eddie Nketiah came on for Zinchenko. Then we had Reece Nelson coming on for Martinelli. The Smith-Rowe discussion has been going on for a while now. I saw him warming up this time at least, but I couldn't help think...
So we know he's alive.
We know he's there. But I couldn't help thinking. I think I sent you a message. My instant reaction to the substitute type thing. You know, I could not help think that when Nelson came on ahead of Smith Rowe, there was, you know, there's fuel to this particular fire, or adding smoke to this particular fire. You know,
and something I think curious is going on. I think there.
And Reece Nelson did very well.
He did very well.
I think you could say that, you know, when it comes down to it, it might well have been the right substitution because he was involved in the Saka goal. I think it was his shot. He also made an absolutely brilliant intervention, didn't he, when Southampton tried to break. I think it was possibly from a corner, and the speed he showed and the strength he showed to hold off the opposition player to allow us to keep the ball. So it's not that Nelson himself was bad, but again, I think it speaks to what's going on with Smith Rowe that he came on first.
I think that's true. I think the subs, to be fair, made a good impact. You know, I think Nelson, as you say, was good. I think Trossard was good. I think Eddie made a difference as well, just having that extra presence in the box. But there is clearly something to this Smith Rowe situation.
It's a bit of a worry, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know anything with any certainty. I gather someone took some of my comments last week out of context and tried to spin it into a story. But
funny that the way that happens.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that anyone could ever do that. But it's strange. It is strange. I mean, especially in a situation where you need a goal. He clearly isn't really trusted at this point in time.
No.
And it's a dramatic change from where he was, you know, not too long ago.
Yeah. So look, Southampton fans are having a ball. They're oleing as they pass the ball around. They're doing the Poznan, which frankly, they can shove right up their holes. I'm all for the bounce and everything else, but you know, if you're doing the Poznan because it's like Man City, go fuck yourselves with that shit. Then we score a goal. Almost out of nothing. I think it's a little 1-2 with Ben White, Martin Odegaard, curls a shot into the bottom corner. And from there, James, I find it so difficult. You know, we've talked a lot, haven't we, in the last couple of weeks about how moments in a game can completely and utterly change the momentum and change the dynamic of what's happening. Because I think Arsenal were sort of huffing and puffing and not looking really like threatening. Then we score a goal and all fucking hell breaks loose in attacking terms.
I think it's belief. I think the belief had been sapped from them by conceding the 2-2 goal leads over the previous two games, by being 3-1 down, staring down the barrel of a defeat. And I think Martin Odegaard deserves massive credit because that was a captain's contribution. I was watching the game sort of 75, 80 minutes, and Arsenal, you know, Southampton, there's a lot of gamesmanship, eating up the clock, as they're completely within their rights to do. It's down to the officials to get better at police in that situation.
Any more time wasting, Bazunu, and I'm going to give you a talking to about more time wasting. And if you do it again, I'm going to pull you aside and we're going to have a quiet word about your time wasting. And after that, if you do it again, well, I'm probably going to have a word with your captain, at which point I'll talk to you again, maybe, about how you just need to speed things up a bit. Fuck me. I mean, listen, he's within his rights to do whatever he wants to do, but the onus is on the officials, isn't it, to say to a goalkeeper, look, you know, there are limits to this shit, dude. So, you know, a yellow card would refocus the mind to an extent.
You're right. But I think, as I said, I was watching it and thinking, I know that not winning this game is heartbreaking, but losing it is catastrophic. And we have to give everything to try and steal even a point, because it being as tight as it is at the top, who knows what a point may be worth.
Absolutely,
the final reckoning. But I don't think it was going to happen until Martin Odegaard stepped up. Captain's contribution, a really excellent goal. And suddenly they felt like they believed again, and they played with so much more conviction.
I mean, they really did. I mean, we scored a second goal, within 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Where, I think it was it Reece Nelson who had a shot. It's saved. It comes back out. I mean, we're camped in their half now. You know, absolutely camped in their half and making chances. And, you know, we were, apart from one moment, which I guess we might talk about, we were patient, which is a difficult thing to be in the circumstances in which we found ourselves. I mean, there was a Jesus shot that was blocked. Remember, I think Eddie had a little bit of a, was a pass from Odegaard into Eddie, knocked it back. And the goal then, when it came, Nelson shot, Bazunu saves, Saka's there to put it home. And there's still 8 minutes then. There's still 8 minutes, which is a lot of time. And we had such a lot of momentum. We could have won it. There's no two ways about it. We could have won that game.
Well, Trossard's inches away from winning it on his own, isn't he?
I mean, what can you imagine? I think we can all imagine. But, you know, that's how close we came. I think you're absolutely right, though. We had to get something from this. A point is underwhelming. Of course it's underwhelming. But we had to do everything we could to take something from this game. And I suppose, you know, if we're going to criticize them for their defending, we have to at least acknowledge that there is something about this team that they will keep going. As we've seen a number of times this season, late on, we get goals that mean things, you know, for the matches that we're playing in, you know?
Yeah, if you're going to do things in this league, you have to have that capacity to turn the screw late on. It's the sign of a good team. And, you know, we have become a side where you can be a goal up, you can be two goals up, and we're entering the last 10 minutes and you aren't safe. You know, they say that about Liverpool at Anfield. They will soon say it about Arsenal, because we have shown, you know, we almost did the impossible. by coming back from 3-1 down on 88 minutes, you know, that would have been extraordinary and the points would have been very welcome. But I think, you know, as good as it would be, we'd still be here. I think if we were being sensible, we'd still be here having conversations about
defending
the performance. You know?
I'm just looking at the Trossard one again.
Don't. It's too
Jesus. Cruel. You know, if he's just 2 yards further out.
I know. And Reece Nelson has an effort, doesn't he? That deflects just wide. And there were a couple of balls in the box again where it's like, if it falls just another inch in the right place, maybe Jesus gets a strike at it, but he doesn't quite manage it. It's
mayhem, isn't it? It's absolute mayhem in those last 7 or 8 minutes. And it's so hard to explain why we do that then rather than, you know, at 2-0 or whatever. Of course, game state plays a part, doesn't it?
Yeah. And psychology of all that is huge. Yeah. And what's going through the Southampton minds and the exhaustion of the Southampton players and, you know, the marathon they're running to try and stay in this league.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean,
it was a crazy game. And I think sometimes we do overlook, when we look at fixture lists, how crazy those kind of top versus bottom games can be. I remember very well, I think it was 2012, something like that, a year we were going for the Champions League and Roberto Martinez and Wigan came and beat us at the Emirates Stadium. And it was like one of those that we all had down as a gimme. They were going down, I think. They were right at the bottom of the league. It was like, well, we'll turn them over. And it just didn't play out like that because they're fighting tooth and nail. And you're safest playing a team in mid-table. Once you get into April, May, you want someone who's safely ensconced in like 10th or 11th. They're the games you want.
No, that's it. Yeah, I mean, there is something to that dynamic when a team is scrapping for its life. And, you know, ultimately, what's kind of amazing about this game, this, you know, another one of those great games for the neutral, is that, like, both teams will have been absolutely heartbroken at that result.
Yeah.
Both of them. Southampton, you know, 2-0 up with, you know, 2 minutes of normal time to go. How big would those 3 points have been? You know, their fans are probably talking this morning about, like, oh man, if we only had another couple of points and then we've got this game and, you know, if we get that, then we're probably safe or whatever. And if only we had the other 2 points, because, you know, it gives us this margin for error. I mean, I guess that's football, but...
Can I ask you about your reaction to the Thomas Partey shot?
I thought it was possibly the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I'm laughing, but I was apoplectic. I could
not believe he did it.
I still can't figure it out. Like, I'm like, it was insane, wasn't it?
Did he have stars insane in his eyes, thinking like, if I put this top corner now, I'm going to be...
Maybe, but there was like space. I remember thinking like, yeah, we had a man over on the right-hand side, I think.
We did. I'm just going to see if I can find it here. Oh, yeah, here it is. Hang on. So the ball comes in from Gabriel. He picks it up. He's like 35, maybe 40 yards out. Like, he's not even in the top of the D or anything like that. He's miles out. It's just the stupidest thing. He's got Martin Odegaard to the right of him. I think it's Ben White. It is Ben White. Outside him again. And Southampton are kind of pulled over a little bit to the left-hand side. So we've got these two players where Odegaard could pick it up. He could play it to Ben White. He can get a ball into the box from a good area and he cracks it over the bar. Oh, just the most maddening moment, to be honest. Really was. And I know that's not why we lost, you hear me? I know not that that's not why we dropped all the points, but when you've got that momentum, and like, if it's a kid, you know, if you throw on an 18-year-old and he gets like, oh, here we go, I could make a name for myself here, but like a guy of his experience, no excuse.
Yeah, it was like karmic payback for anyone who's ever gone shoot when he had the ball. Yeah, it was sort of staggering. Like, it verged on... I don't want to say this, it feels really harsh, but, like, it wasn't very professional.
No, it was. I mean? It was completely unprofessional.
Yeah.
Completely unprofessional. I mean, you can see Odegaard outside him just sort of put his hands on his head, like, what the fuck are you doing?
I know.
You know?
Because even if it goes a yard wide or a yard over, that's too far. You know, like Arsenal were in a position there where we were really turning the screw, really able to dominate the space and create chances.
Well, I mean, that's it. Southampton were camped in their own penalty area. Where did the Odegaard goal come from? Edge of the area. Yeah. Where we'd forced them backwards. Where did the Saka goal come from? We played the ball into the box. It was laid off. Nelson shot. And Saka is there inside the area. He's like, what, 10 yards out? You know, this is where we had to get the ball. We had to get the ball in those areas. And even subsequently, you know, the couple of scrambles that were there where it didn't quite fall for Jesus. And Jesus, you know, I think he tried to buy a penalty you know, at least once. It's one of those where in the sort of in the mayhem of what's happening, the referee goes, oof! Well, of course, it has to be a penalty. I don't think it was,
by the
way. He was
looking for it 100%.
He was 100% looking for it. But, you know, that I can understand a bit more than what Thomas Partey did there. And I'm not saying we would have scored had he kept the ball moving, but he should have kept the ball moving. And
but
that's
maybe
all,
that's pressure, you know? Maybe that's tired minds, stressed minds. Maybe there's a kind of anxiety and panic in that. It expresses itself in different ways. And I guess you'd have to file that alongside it. And I gave praise to Martinelli for what he produced while he was on the pitch in that last period. Yeah, full of praise for Martin Odegaard. Mm. And I think Leandro Trossard as well, who was very, very good.
Yes.
At just kind of doing the intelligent thing, you know, having a clear head under intense pressure.
Mm. But unfortunately, it was a bit too little too late.
Yeah.
And we did drop those 2 points. I mean, what else is there to say? I'm sure we have some other topics to discuss, but probably in questions.
I guess so. I'm just having a little flick. No, there's nothing else to say about it, really. I mean, I'm sure there'll be questions that will touch on individuals and Wednesday and all sorts of things.
Okay. Well, let's take a little break here because it's been over an hour for part one because, you know, that there has been a lot to talk about. So we'll take a little break and we'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you sent to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog. No longer with a blue check, and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. He didn't offer to pay for yours. He didn't foist the blue tick on you, no?
He did, of course. I was one of the first people he called. But as you know, Andrew, I'm a man of the people.
Sure are.
So, no blue tick.
Stick your fucking blue tick up your arse. I think
like
that's
Samson
what you
said. And they cut his hair off. Yeah. He's powerless now.
Just
5-1 at St. James's Park, by the way.
5-1. Okay,
that,
one.
A scoreline I have some affection for. I believe that was the final score in 2016.
Oh, it was, When 10-man Newcastle beat Tottenham, yes. I remember it well.
Indeed.
Just want to give a quick mention to the fundraiser that we are doing with our friends at Arsenal Vision, raising funds for the Arsenal Foundation. The remarkable total right now, having initially set a target of £100,000, we are currently at £364,136. It's absolutely incredible. There's been a couple of really big donations as well, but they have followed the lead of you guys as part of our community here and part of the Arsenal Vision community, who have been so generous and kind and have contributed so much to what the Arsenal Foundation does and is going to do in the future. So, yeah, it's just amazing. And just to say thank you, there's still a few days of April to go. The Arseblog donation has yet to be added to this total. So let's see where we end up with that one. The other thing I just want to mention is that tomorrow we will be announcing details, or maybe later today, I don't know, I have to chat with Elliot, of our end-of-season live event, again with the Arsenal Vision guys, same place as last year, James, good fun, Union Chapel in Islington.
Yeah.
Tickets will be going on sale on Tuesday. Patreon members will get first access to those tickets. So
they went very quickly last time.
They certainly did. So if you want to sign up for Patreon, you can do that. Patreon.com/Arseblog. And just to be clear, if you sign up at any point in the month of April, your subscription will go to the Arsenal Foundation fundraiser. So not only do you get first access to tickets and get all the extra stuff that we do on there, you will be giving money to a good cause as well. So keep an eye on the Patreon. We'll give full details of that, but tickets will be on sale on Tuesday, and it is going to be happening at the end of the season, the last Saturday of the season at Union Chapel in Islington. So looking forward to that one way or the other, I have to say.
Yeah, listen, it'll be... we'll have quite the story to tell about this season, whatever happens.
That is true. That is true. Now, questions. Do you want to go first?
No.
Okay. All right then. Let me ask you this one then.
Go on.
We talked about defensive issues, and we talked about the goals we're conceding, and where we're going into a game like this, I think we need to be more defensively solid. So we've got questions about our defending. Or possible changes to defending. This one comes from Big Tall Paul on the Discord. He says, it appears obvious we need to make a change in defence for the City game. If Saliba doesn't make a miraculous return, is Ben White at centre-half and Tierney at right-back a potential sticking plaster?
Maybe. It's so difficult, isn't it? It's like, it hasn't been working. But do you try something new in the biggest game, probably not just of this season, but for quite a long time? I mean, I don't know if you can. I think it might be too risky to kind of tear up the blueprint, even if it's not been hugely effective. I mean, my first option, my preference is, you know,
the miraculous somehow, recovery?
Yeah, exactly. Somehow we feel the cadaver of William Saliba and magically he's good and fine. Failing that, I think Kieran Tierney has played right back in his career once or twice. I've got a funny feeling he did it for Scotland because of the old Andy Robertson, Kieran Tierney issue. My brain just doesn't quite accept a left-footed right-back. I know it sounds absurd, but like my brain sort of slightly struggles with it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You see it so rarely.
You very, very rarely see it, to be honest. You'll see a right-footed left-back semi-frequently.
And there is a reason, by the way, and the reason is that it's a generalisation, but in general, I think right-footed players are, in their development, more encouraged to use their weak foot and develop that aspect of their game. So I think a right-footed player probably on average, on like a global scale, is more two-footed than a left-footed player who his whole life has been told, play left-back, play left-wing, play on the left.
You've got a cultured left foot.
Exactly. I just think that the left-footed players are kind of, not indulged, but they're sort of there's less need for them to develop that the other side and play on the other side. And therefore... they tend to be a bit more one-footed. Yeah.
I mean, I won't lie to you. I have been doing the thing that a lot of people do. I've been going through all the various permutations of, you know, what could we do? What could we do to change things up? Could we bring Ben White into the center? Then who do we play on the right? There's no ideal candidate there. Could we go to a back three? It's not impossible that you could play a back three of Ben White, Gabriel, and even Kieran Tierney, maybe, yeah. or Kivior. You never know. Then you've got wing backs. I mean,
do we have a right wing back in this?
We don't really have a right wing back, but we've got Bukayo Saka, who has played as a wing back in his time, so knows the role. How then does that change the, you know, the dynamic of the team and their, you know, their various passing patterns and all that kind of stuff? You know, I've been through pretty much everyone you can think of. Thomas Partey at centre half, perhaps bring Jorginho into midfield.
The one that I know that you hate it, and I, to be honest, have hated it. But the one that I wonder it you could do would be Partey at right back with Jorginho in midfield and play Ben White next to Gabriel.
You see the problem. Yeah, you could. I just don't know about Jorginho in midfield against
like
a team
okay
like Man City.
I feel like he was okay in the first game. Was he not against them?
I mean, I think he was fine. I just wonder if
he might be overrun.
Maybe overrun a little bit. I mean, my sense is, right, for this game, I'll tell you two things. One, I would not be surprised if there was a bit of a switcheroo somewhere from Mikel Arteta defensively. Yeah. Would not be surprised if we fielded a backline without Rob Holding in it. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't
know. How much of this is on him?
Because see, I feel like there is an element of him being a bit of a lightning rod, right?
Yeah.
But then there's all the statistics that are coming out and, you know, the way that, like, even as you said in the first half, the fact that Partey was dropping into that right centre back position to pick up the ball, to progress it up the pitch, you know, that says something. And in a way, I kind of feel a little bit sorry for Rob Holding, that the player he's come in for has been one of our best players, William Saliba. You know, he's absolutely been one of our best players. So it's a difficult thing to live up to. I just wonder if we might see a back four without him in it. I said there was going to be two things. Oh, the other thing I was going to say was that I think for this game, and we're not exactly short of them, but I just wonder if we might be best with the most technical players we can get onto the pitch. The more technical players we can get on the pitch, the better.
Isn't Jorginho one, though?
He is, yeah. But so is Leandro Trossard. Mm-hmm. Who could potentially play as the eight.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he did very well, albeit in a kind of attack versus defence scenario.
Yeah, true.
Which is probably not what it's going to be at the Etihad.
probably not. But it might be more open than people think.
Yeah, and also, I mean, yeah, City do give up chances, I think. And listen, a little tiny little playmaker dropping into midfield, having a great game at the Etihad.
Sounds familiar.
There's some precedent for that. Just on Holding, listen, clearly we're hurt by Saliba's absence, and it is compounded by Tomiyasu's absence. I mean, I've got no doubt that if Tomiyasu was fit, Rob Holding's not playing currently.
No, he's not. No, no way.
So it's those two things in concert which are really problematic. I do think some of our defensive frailties predate Saliba's absence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the set piece issue was there before that. I'm looking through fixture lists. You know, we conceded 2 to Sporting, 2 to Bournemouth, 2 to Aston Villa. You know, goals against Palace and the like, in games that we completely dominated, probably didn't need to concede. So again, I think it's not right to kind of scapegoat him entirely in this situation. And there were games where he came in and looked okay, you know, we sort of were fine. But clearly it's a worry. And I have bad memories of that first half in the FA Cup where he was playing right on the edge. You know, it was reminiscent of the game he had against Spurs.
At White Hart Lane, yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, in order to live with his opponent, or to try and live with his opponent, he had to take a very aggressive approach. and one that I don't think would have seen him last the 90 minutes had he stayed on.
I agree. Like I said, I feel a bit sorry for him. I think there are clearly differences between him and Saliba. Saliba is not a one-man band, though, when it comes to defending. I don't think he is the sticking plaster to all of our defensive deficiencies, right?
No.
I think he would make us better, obviously, of course. But at the same time, I think there's an onus on the collective as well. When you are down an important player or two, you've got to find ways to be able to cope with that. And maybe you can look at the manager and ask a question or two there as well about how do we organize ourselves to cope defensively. I think it. I think there's a sort of weight of something going on here that might just preempt a change for Wednesday, and I don't quite know what it's going to be, but I wouldn't be at all surprised.
My thing is, to my mind, our best chance at City is our attacking threat. You know, I don't see a scenario where we go there and grind out a 0-0. It's not to say it won't happen, but I don't think we look well placed to do that currently. And so I'm wary of a system change that would involve, for example, repurposing Martinelli and Saka as wing-backs or something like that. I feel like we need to retain the strong departments of the team that we do have as far as possible.
Mm. George Graham went to a back three at Anfield 89.
Yeah,
That was a one-off game, and I don't think it's quite the same. I think as much as we need to get something from this one, it's not winner takes all necessarily. There's still, you know, some games to go where other shit could happen. Could.
Oh yeah.
Maybe listen, not, but could.
And if City win all their games, and you know, what can you say if they do that? But they do have fixtures beyond this one where there could be a slip. I mean, any fixture can be a slip. So I think we have to stay in contention. I think we have to not lose. Lord only knows how we go about doing that. Mm. I wonder if he will consider the Jorginho midfield, dropping Partey into the back somewhere. I wonder if he will do that. Just because, as I say, Jorginho is a very technical player. I think there are games that suit him and games that don't. And I happen to think City is one that could suit him, you know, more than, say, an Everton.
Mm.
But we shall see.
Yeah. Okay. Your question.
SM Design, we talked about it a bit in part one. SM Design says, is there a tactical reason I'm missing for starting Vieira over Trossard? Wouldn't it make more sense to be playing Trossard in midfield?
I mean, the only thing I can think of is that, A, they sort of view that as Vieira's position in the long term.
Yeah.
And B, having Trossard on the bench gives you a really good option from the bench if you need it in a game where you're holding something back, holding something in reserve, you know, sort of putting all your irons in the fire at once.
The amount of money that we spent on Fabio Vieira is a factor here? I mean, for a club in our position, the money that we spent on him, although it wasn't the, you know, big signing of the summer because we were all more excited about Jesus maybe, or more excited about Zinchenko, still a lot of money. Mm. And do you think there's any possibility that he's getting these minutes because club feel they've made this really substantial investment in him and so they've got to make a success of it?
I mean, there's probably a reason why they paid all the money.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they wouldn't have paid all that money if they didn't think he was a good player or didn't have the potential to come in and play and be a first-team regular. So, you know, maybe the two things are directly connected. I'm not sure they're playing him because they paid that money. But the fact that they paid that money suggests that they think that there's a really good player in there. Like I said earlier, I think what this game showed is that he's not quite there yet. He's not quite ready yet. He probably needs, he's never going to be the biggest guy in the world, but I think you do need to be a little more physical, a little more robust. And I think that's part of what they need to do with him in order to develop him. Lots of players have had an indifferent first season at a football club and then come good when they understand the league a little bit better. So that's the only reason I can think of. You know, A, this was his position, and B, they just wanted to hold Trossard back. Like I said, in hindsight, I think Mikel Arteta would probably do something different, but that's a hindsight type thing. Mm-hmm. Here's one from Scrumpy Lungs on the Discord. He said, do you think there's a correlation between our drop-off in results and the players/manager talking much more about the title run? It seems that since it stopped being one game at a time, we've become more and more complacent.
Maybe. I mean, it is a different beast, a title run-in. I do think, talk all you want about one game at a time, you know, that's not how the players would have felt when West Ham equalised the other day, or when they went 1-0 down against Southampton with a minute on the clock. Everything has this bigger context, and all those moments, a missed pass from Aaron Ramsdale, a missed penalty from Bukayo Saka, the ramifications feel so much greater. Yeah, I'm sure it is a factor. And in a funny way, if you're looking for a positive, maybe it will help Arsenal that I feel like it's not right to say the pressure is off them now, but I think most people make Man City favourites at this point in time. And the expectations of Arsenal at the Etihad are pretty low. And who knows? That's a different scenario, isn't it? It might suit them more. Yeah. I think inevitably the fact that we are in a title race has played its part in, you know, some of the sort of psychological issues we've faced in the last few games. Do you agree?
Yeah, of course. Just the way way a season goes. But I don't think it's the fact that they've been talking about it has generated a complacency or anything like that. I mean, there was a point where nobody was talking about it, because nobody wanted to sort of jinx it, if you like. And then it becomes clear as the season goes on that, you know, this is the reality of where you are. And then you have to talk about it, you know? You have to talk about it. You it's just part of what's going on in your season. Same if you were right at the bottom of the table, nobody would want to talk about relegation. But if you're, you know, sitting bottom and you've got 23 points or 24 points, that is going to be the thing that people talk about. So I don't get any sense from the players or the manager or anything that they've said or done that anyone is talking about this, or anyone has ever talked about this in anything other than an aspirational way. Like, this is an ambition. This is something they want to do. This is something they're desperate to achieve. Nobody has said, like, yeah, we're going to win the title, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's going to be easy from here. So I don't see that the things are connected. I do think there is something to just what happens at this point of a season, that it affects players, it affects teams time and time and time again, not just Arsenal. Pretty much every team, you know, that's ever done anything at the business end of the table has experienced something like this as well.
Yeah, you know? And I think until you do it, until you kind of break the back of it, until you win that trophy, yeah, there's always that doubt. You doubt yourself. Am I able to do this? Am I right? Am I the right person? Are we good enough?
Think about Man City's first one.
Yeah.
You know, it's what were they playing? 10-man Queen's Park Rangers, and they needed a goal in the last minute of injury time or whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, that's how tight these things can be.
Absolutely. And the first one's the most difficult and the most important.
Yeah.
Magnus Holmberg on Twitter says, what happened to the legal action against Man City? Have you heard anything recently that would indicate an outcome before the end of the season?
I saw a few questions like that. And look,
do you remember people saying, like, we don't want legal action against City because we don't want an asterisk on it when we win the league?
Give me the fucking asterisks. Give me all the asterisks. I'll take them.
Take an asterisk right now.
I don't. I don't think anything will happen. I mean, you know, of course, Manchester City should be ruthlessly punished to the full extent of the law, whatever it is, the regulations. Like, take all their points, relegate them, take all their Premier League titles off them. That's what I personally would like, for me and for you and for everybody listening to this, of course. But I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen between now and the end of the season. That if anyone's thinking about that as their safety net, stay on the high wire, guys.
Yeah, I wouldn't be waiting on that to come through.
Is it my question? I think, yeah. Okay. I had one here. Boom. Okay, it's a bit speculative, but Gateshead Gooner says, what do you make of the links to Mason Mount? Does the arrival of a potential new left-sided eight mean Smith Rowe will be sold, or could it be a sign that Vieira might be loaned out to get the game time he needs to deal with the physical demands of the Premier League?
Yeah, I like it. I'll say that. And I've sort of been waiting for Arsenal to see if Arsenal would make a serious move on Mason Mount. And to be fair, I think it's Charles Watts' story. I don't think that's what he's written, and that's accurate. I think it's that they are sort of interested. It's kind of a watching brief. Mason Mount is probably going to leave Chelsea this summer. And I think there are two or three positions in this Arsenal team he could play. I think he could play where Fabio Vieira played on Friday night. I think he could play off the left. I think he could play where Martin Odegaard plays. I think he's a very able footballer and a little bit underappreciated. And the Chelsea fans in my life are very complimentary about him.
Mm.
He's best mates with Declan Rice and very close with the Arsenal boys who are part of the England setup.
6-1, by the way.
I know. I'm refreshing every couple of minutes. Don't you worry about that. So I think it would make quite a lot of sense. The issue would be money, and it's, I'd say, more so even on the salary than the fee, because his issue at Chelsea is basically that they've not agreed to his demands. And I think wherever he goes, you know, Liverpool have been very interested, and I think that's sort of much more advanced at this point in time. You're talking about a wage between £200,000 and £300,000 a week.
Oof.
Yeah. Well, so it's not nothing. It's a lot.
I mean, yeah. I think he's a good player. My gut feeling on this was like that it was maybe a bit agent-y, in that like we're a good club to be linked with at this moment in time. Like I can see how he could fit in, but I just wonder if this is ahead of the end of this. Well, I mean, Chelsea season is basically over anyway.
Very much so.
A way of sort of putting him out there, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And to be fair, like the story is, as I say, it's not the idea that, you know, Arsenal have made a bid or are close to making a bid. It's just that they like the player, and that is true. They do like the player, but they've made a lot more ground with certain other summer targets, including Declan Rice, for example, than they have with Mount at this point in time. So it's not like he's top of any lists or priorities. It's more the case that I've been looking at it and thinking, well, he's going to move this summer, and he ticks a number of boxes in terms of the type of footballer he is, the positions he plays, the age profile. I think it makes a degree of sense. Maybe the salary is where it falls down. So we shall see. But I think Arsenal are going to, you know, I think they're very aware that they are now qualified. On the verge.
Mm.
And I think they're very aware that they don't have a Champions League squad at this point. So they need numbers and they need quality.
I mean, a part of that question was about Smith Rowe, and then there was another question on Discord from You've Been Dozed, who said, with Nelson ahead of Smith Rowe in the pecking order, do you think this may be an issue of Smith Rowe having difficulty bringing his training up a level? The standard has been raised from last season. Reese is playing for a new contract and delivering in the minimal minutes he's getting. Friday, he took a shot on target that deflected to Saka for the equaliser. And there was the other one we talked about where he did this sort of dance of frustration as it deflected wide. And he says, so why not give the minutes to a guy fighting for his future who's delivering over the guy who's still recovering from groin surgery? If he is still recovering from groin surgery, I'm not sure that that's it.
No, he's fit, as far as I'm aware. And it's interesting as well, did you see that moment with Arteta in a press conference where a reporter was listing all the attacking options he's got at his disposal, and he kind of went, and Reese? And you feel like, would he say and Emile right now? I don't know. Yeah. What was the question?
I mean, is it about the standard? Yeah.
I do think that Emile is suffering slightly from being part of the same cohort as Martinelli and Saka. I think that they are a very specific type of personality where there is like an absolute clarity of focus and enormous drive and very palpable like hunger. And I think that Emile is a more gentle soul, but no less talented.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, doesn't work any less hard. I think if you look at his numbers on the pitch, he covers a lot of ground. He's a great athlete. But I just think he's less sort of extroverted and obviously one of those guys who like will run through a wall.
Yeah.
And I get the sense that Arteta is trying to elicit that sort of behaviour from Emile Smith Rowe. And I'm not convinced that that's who Emile Smith Rowe is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean him not useful or not good, but it does feel like maybe there's just the chemistry between coach and player at this point in time. It feels like it's not quite right.
I think that's probably as good an explanation as I've heard, to be honest, because it's not about talent. We know the talent is there. Yeah. It is probably more about something to do with his approach or his attitude or whatever it is. And, you know, I'm not saying he has a bad attitude by any means. I just do wonder if in his attempts to raise the level across the board, there are going to be some casualties across the way. You know, that whole thing we talked about players we like leaving. You know, if you'd said this to me at the start of the season, I would have said no way with regard to Smith Rowe.
No.
But I wouldn't be overly shocked now if something happened.
Yeah, there were times in the first half of the season where I thought, I have had the thought he could go, but I was really thinking maybe next summer. It just feels like at a time when you're going into the Champions League, we just spoke about depth and quality and what someone like Mason Mount might bring. Well, Emma Smith-Rowe is here. And
yeah.
He's on the books and he's an Arsenal Academy boy. And he's done pretty well for us when he's had the opportunity. So
that's true.
It is a strange one. It is a strange one. And you almost wonder if they're sort of sending him a message, you know, or they're trying to, if they're sort of pushing him towards the exit. I don't know, but it's odd. And I don't think anything indicates we're suddenly going to see him between now and the end of the season. There have been enough circumstances where it's like, well, you would bring on Smith Rowe here, and he hasn't.
Yeah. Can we just do one more? Because I've got to go. I've got to drop my daughter out to the airport. I've got to get this podcast up, and we've been going long enough anyway. Rat Bear on the Discord said, should we talk a bit more about the Kane trademark foul from Martinelli on Bednarek? I think we rightly slander Kane for it, so we should not accept it from our players.
Yeah, do you know what? I haven't seen it that many times because Sky, understandably, didn't really show replays of the incident because he landed on the back of his neck. So there's quite a long period where they didn't show it. I have seen it again since. I don't think it's... I'm biased. But I don't think it's quite as egregious as some of the Kane ones.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I don't think there's as much malice to it. But then I would say that. But they are a bit of a scourge, those challenges. And I'm not going to turn a blind eye to it just because it's an Arsenal player. They are dangerous. And, you know, it's up there with pushing someone into the hoardings, really. It's something that's avoidable and very, very high risk.
Yeah, I prefer he didn't do it. Like you, I don't think it's quite like the Kane one. I think he just sort of stands his ground as much as anything. But no, I don't like it. I did say to you, didn't I, on WhatsApp, that when it happened, Gary Neville taking umbrage at this kind of challenge from Martinelli when Kane has done much worse time and time and time again really annoyed me, which isn't to make any excuses for Martinelli. Don't do that. I don't think you should. And, you know, the fact that they took Bednarek off, despite the fact he was up again and was absolutely fuming and wanted to play, the fact that they took him off is tells you how serious his landing was. So maybe he was concussed or maybe he could have, you know, whatever. And that's not nice. And you don't want to see that happen to anyone, you know, at the hands of any Arsenal player. But it did kind of annoy me that all of a sudden Gary Neville doesn't like those challenges.
Yeah, well, there's a big difference, isn't there, between one incident with Gabriel Martinelli and a repeat offender in the case of Harry Kane. But, you know, I think we've got to be big enough and grown up enough to say it was a bad challenge and he should cut it out.
I think that's fair. Okay, look, we're going to have to leave it there for this particular episode. Join us tomorrow on Patreon. We'll have an episode of The 30. Phil Costa and I will review the weekend's Premier League action for you. On Tuesday, we'll have a Premier League preview podcast, of course, looking ahead to the game against a small game. Can't remember who we're playing.
We're going to do a podcast as well, aren't we?
We are. We're going to do a...
Lick our wounds.
The wounds of celebration as I claw my forearms into ribbons with joy at the Bukayo Saka hat-trick that he's going to score at the Etihad. We'll have an extra Arsecast extra for you on Thursday. Please do join us for all of that. In the meantime, have a great weekend and we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.